Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. This is our final show for 2014, just 3 days before the winter solstice, an important milestone for all we Alaskans, knowing that our light is seeping and creeping back more and more each day. The solstice is one of the reasons we're here today, thanks to the creativity and inspiration of a loose band of local artists and a young city that wants to celebrate its first 100 years. In just 3 days, on Saturday, December 20th, one of the first birthday celebrations for Anchorage will unfold in a light and sound art installation in downtown Anchorage, right at Elderberry Park. On today's Hometown Alaska, you'll get some context for this visual and sound event. What inspired these artists? How and from what did they fashion this ambitious creation? How does their work fit into the centennial celebration? And why does an agency that works to grow a thriving city, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, or AEDC, why do they see importance and value in this work? You'll learn all of that and more today. I'd like to welcome our panel of guests. First, there's Bruce Farnsworth with the Light Brigade. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having us on.
Well, I'm so glad you're here, and I know you're sleep deprived, so we will keep kicking you and waking you up if you fall asleep during the show.
Okay.
And we also have Susan Duck. I'm calling you Queen of All Things Centennial, but really you're the Mayor's Special Assistant for the Centennial Project.
I am. It is one of my projects and my main huge project.
Right now.
Yes.
Like throwing a big wedding for the whole city.
Pretty much.
And then we have Mike Prozzarelli. I knew I was going to do this. Okay. He's co-chair of the AEDC Live, Work, Play Steering Committee. Welcome, Mike, and go ahead and tell them how you really say your name.
It's Prozzarelli, and thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure being here.
We're so happy you could be here. Thanks so much. I also want to say to our listeners, if you have questions about Follow the Light, that's the name of the project, you can already see pieces of it going up at Elderberry Park if you've been wandering around and wondering what that is. But if you have questions about that project, or you have questions about the centennial and what's up, or if you're in a centennial event yourself, we'd love to hear from you today, and you can give us a call. Our numbers here at the studio are 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or you can send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's get started. I do like to go around and just talk to our guests just a tiny bit. So I'm just going to start with Susan. You work for the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Are you from Anchorage?
I have been here 12 years. My youngest daughter, I drove the Alcan, 9 months pregnant with my youngest who just turned 12. So
wow.
I feel like I've been here a long time being a military brat. But according to Anchorage and Alaska standards, I guess you're still a newcomer.
You're just a newcomer. And the Centennial Project, how did that become your baby?
Well, I had been at Anchorage Ferrandi for 8 years and had resigned and was trusting my gut that something new was going to come along, and had a weekend end of panic being a single mother. I thought, what have I done?
Yeah, how could I do that?
I thinking? Yeah. Follow your gut. What's that? And then on Monday morning, Mayor Sullivan called and asked if I would take on the Anchorage Centennial. So it did work out.
Wow, that's a good story. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, so Bruce, let's get a little bit of your story out.
What would you like to know?
Well, I know that your grandfather invented the television, but we don't have to go back that far.
It was actually my great-great uncle, but
yes,
that's okay.
Yes. Those people, they always get it wrong. Yeah,
I've lived here much longer than any place else I've ever lived. And I've grown to really think of it as home. And like a lot of people, I moved up here for adventure thinking, oh, this will be big fun for a year. And that was about 35 years ago. And
that's
so,
what I did. Yeah. I can do anything for a year.
Right, precisely.
Here I am, still here.
And I really don't think I would live any place else, at least in the U.S., and I'm a founding member of the art group Light Brigade that is responsible for putting together, you know, planning and executing the Follow the Light project.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we'll get into the details of that.
We are definitely going to get into the details and even a little bit of the history and some of the other things you've done. So if people saw that and that they loved that, they're, oh, well, these are the same folks over here. So, and Mike, let's go to you. I know you're an architect here in Anchorage. Are you from Anchorage?
No, I'm not. I originally grew up on the East Coast, went to school and worked in Boston for 12 years before I came here in 91.
Why Anchorage?
Actually, it was kind of an interesting story. I came up here with a friend of mine, and we went fishing for 3 weeks. And 8 months later, I was packing up and moving across the country.
That's great. You know, I'm going to tell you, I came to visit my brother, and I went back and packed up and came back, too. So it has an effect on people. Yeah. And my I'm from a military family, and this is the longest I've ever lived anywhere because you're, you know, 2 years here, 2 years there.
For right.
I've been here a long time. Okay. So, well, now people know you a little bit about you. Let's go to Bruce and talk a little bit about what Follow the Light is.
Well, excuse me. The Light Brigade has been making work for a few years. I mean, we took a break after our original urban art intervention, as we call the work, for lack of a better way to refer to it. And then we made a series of pieces, and all of our past work has been really hyper-ephemeral, and by that I just mean it's
blink
been,
and it's gone.
Yeah, if you're not there or you show up 30 minutes late, it's over and you missed it and you'll never see it again. Mm-hmm. You can see a version of it because we document our work pretty well, and if anybody's interested and isn't familiar with it, they can just go to our website and take a look.
AKLightBrigade.com. Okay.
And but after we completed our last really large-scale piece of work, which was we called Over, Beyond, Across, Through, or internally OBAT for short, which was a multimedia and performance piece on the Anchorage Museum facade, we decided we really wanted to do something just radically different than what we had been doing. And so one of our core four members, as we call our sort of permanent group that stays through together through all of the projects, one of our I think it was Sheila Wine, the sculptor and designer and who's part of the core four, suggested that we do the next large scale piece of work we do should be something actually made of molecules instead of photons. And suggested that we think about a sculptural installation to be the sort of the foundation.
Just leave it to the sculptor to bring that up.
Yeah, there was some eyebrows raised about the possible self-interested origins of that idea. But
yeah.
No, it was actually good because we really do. I mean, if there's anything that kind of, I think, defines our sort of motivation in our practice is just to always do something completely different than we've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a good business model because
because you're learning each time you do it.
Right. I mean, by the time we finish a project, we actually know how to do it. And so we want to just go and now we can really do it. But it doesn't work that way because it's already done.
Yeah. And it's over.
Can I jump in? Because when Bruce and I, early on in the Centennial, when he came to see me and he shared the work that they had been doing and the I was stunned. I had no idea that this was going on in our community. Obviously, I'm not on the right mailing list. Well, I am now.
Yeah.
But it's just such a beautiful, wonderful asset to the community. And it is so unique that I really encourage people to go to the website and get a feel for what to expect, because there's nothing else like it in the city.
Right. Oh, yes. You will not have seen anything like this.
I
want to just say that on alaskapublic.org, we have a slideshow that Bruce provided. Actually, Michael Conte is the photographer, I think, documenting you as you go along. We have a little slideshow there that kind of, you see the park in the summer, you see it with snow, then you see some schematics of what it might look like here pretty soon, and then you see some of the actual work getting done in a big open space that's kind of cool. So if you're kind of struggling to figure out what are they talking about, you can go to the website and get a little sniff of that. Also, we've included there was a nice, interesting piece in the press kind of introducing this and the other Northern Placemaking events going on. And there's a lot there that you can read about. If you don't know what Northern Placemaking is, you can go to alaskapublic.org. These are all links I got through Bruce or from other people, but tried to centralize them. So if you hear something today that kind of piques your interest, you can go dig around and find out a little bit more. So let's see. Did you get to say what you want to say, Bruce, or do we?
Pretty much. I want to make just one quick response to something Susan said. First of all, thanks. I remember that very well, going to your office and
you didn't know each other.
We didn't know each other, not at all.
Sizing each other up.
But by the time I left, I felt like we were going to be collaborators, and that's always a really great feeling, and it turned out to be accurate. But if you take Susan's advice and you go to our website and you look at the past work, one thing you don't want to do is come to Elderberry Park over the course of the next 3 weeks expecting to see anything like that. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, we decided to go in a really, really different direction. And instead of a 30-minute kind of light and sound-based media piece, this is going to be the largest light and sound sculpture we are pretty sure anybody's ever made in Alaska. And the idea here is you're not going to go to an event. There's not going to be any big spectacle. It's a quiet yet and contemplative experience. Go to the park, stand and look at it, walk down onto the bike path, walk up through the tunnel, and in doing so, you will be participating in the piece because you will be triggering motion detection sensors that will actually activate both the sound and the lights that are part of the installation. And it's more about individual and groups of people in the community going and experiencing art in a way that's immersive, that it's not you looking at somebody doing something that's supposed to pleasure you or impress you. It's you being in the park, in nature, and in a part of the urban landscape, participating in the work of a group of artists.
Yeah, it almost makes me think people might create something else after the experience. You know, they might write something, they might photograph it in a way, or you might contribute to it.
It's very evocative.
Yeah, yeah. So let's bring Mike in here a little bit. Mike, you were the co-chair for the AEDC Live, Work, Play initiative, and how did you get tangled up with this crew?
With Bruce and his group? Well, at the very beginning, you know, Live, Work, Play started in 2009 at AEDC during a strategic planning session. And then right after, we formulated the vision and we came up with a number of things that we needed to do with getting community participation. We started reaching out to different organizations, different people within the community to help us formulate the vision, which is a 6-page document that the community wrote, along with helping us determine from that narrative what our metrics would be. And Bruce was one of the early participants in our play committee that talked about different components of how you play within a community. And the creative placemaking piece came from our awareness and our desire to really start emphasizing art within our city and the significance that art has on the economy, also the community well-being of a community, and how the different things that art can do to inspire the citizens to make these public and private spaces more interactive. And Bruce has done a great job over the last few years of being able to do that.
Oh, that's great. I think having watched Bruce work, you have an amazing ability to, and you're not alone. I know you don't like to be thought of as, oh, Bruce did all this. There's the core four, and then there's a legion of volunteers that step up and make a lot of things happen. But your ability to move around in various circles and find a connection or a link or a how are we the same more than how are we different is really unique and really helps make things like this happen. So it's not, I mean, everyone loves artists. They love their work, but they don't always know how to talk to them, for example, or artists mm-hmm. don't always know how to talk to, you know, right. the economic community. And another piece of it is we've had art in Anchorage for a long time. We have a wonderful museum and we have art galleries and things like that, but this is different. This is something a little less attached to brick and mortar, you know, it goes to the streets, really.
This term that has arisen, creative placemaking, is kind of new to people and us, including, really. I mean, it's a fairly new term of art, and it's really, it means a lot of different things to different people. But it's another way to think of it is as temporary public art, mm-hmm. and it's not the kind because it's temporary and. And no municipality that we know of has yet been able to come up with a way to include it as part of their, say, 1% for art programs and so on.
Although because it's not permanent?
Because it's not permanent, and maybe that would call into question the appropriateness of investing public money in something that there's no remaining tangible evidence of having taken place and so on. And yet I think that's going to change. I really think people are hungry for different kinds of ways to experience art. And we've noticed that. I mean, We were surprised ourselves, actually, at the response that people had. We were doing something we were just really interested in doing. And yeah, you're right, by the way. I really want to I want to make it clear that this kind of work is really a group effort. I mean, in the truest sense of the word, it's collaborative. There's really no other good way to do it. I mean, our experiences have been kind of in the nature of an experiment in terms of collaboration among artists, because, you know, that's not an automatic thing that artists always want to do. Most artists are singular in their vision. They're solitary in their practice a lot of times. And the idea of bringing creators together and having them kind of create something together is a little bit counterintuitive for a lot of artists.
It's not easy.
And it's not easy. And we don't always succeed at, I mean, it doesn't always come off like a super seamless and smooth process. But we learn each time from it. And we learn about ourselves and our, you know, what makes it possible for us to work well with other people. And we learn about other of our friends and collaborators and who we may continue to love and whose work we may admire, but maybe they aren't really cut out for this kind
right.
of work. And, you know, it's that kind of thing. But it really does take this whole team. And these people, I mean, this piece, for example, that's going up right now, I mean, it's a highly technical piece. It's very, very complex. And if it wasn't for, you know, Scott Pugh and Sheila Wine and Sean Amato and John Coyne and Ryan Anderson and others that are really, really key. If I took away any one of those people out of that mixture of this thing, it just would not happen, period.
So I've been over to the church on Spinard Road that is being called the Church of Love. It's a huge space, which makes it possible to do some of this work, which we're going to talk about. I want to throw out the numbers one more time. If you just joined us, this is Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Follow the Light, which is a sound and art installation that's going up even as we speak at Elderberry Park, really launching on the solstice, December 20th. So that's when you want to gather around and take a look at it. But give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 outside of Anchorage, or give us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Just to let you know, we have Susan Duck from the city, Centennial Queen, or the Centennial Project person. We have Bruce Farnsworth, who is here representing a whole slew of people, the Light Brigade, the folks who are actually launching this event, which goes on for 3 weeks, which is very different for what you've done before, as we were talking earlier. And then Mike, I'm going to really try hard on this, Mike Prozorolik. I think I got it. Okay.
Good job.
Yay! He is a local architect, and he's co-chair of the Live, Work, Play initiative at the AEDC, and we heard a little bit about that earlier. So here's a couple of questions that I just want to throw out. Okay.
Nope. You're in the hot seat, Bruce.
Well, if you know the answers, you can leap in.
Is there a buzzer?
Yeah. There's money involved here.
Oh.
Okay. The thing I like about it, this is a centennial celebration. One of the things Bruce said to me was, well, yes, Anchorage is 100 years old, but we're sort of looking ahead to the next 100 years. That's what we're kind of thinking about. And when Susan arrived, I was talking to her a little about it, and she said, well, you know, it really works both ways because they use these, and I'm going to let Bruce tell you what it is. They use these vintage items from the city of Anchorage. So tell us a little bit about that and what you did with them, because they don't look like vintage holiday light, you know, decorations anymore.
So. Not anymore. Don't know exactly what they look like, but that's part of the interesting aspect of visiting this piece is to look at them and not so much try to figure out what they're based on or what they're trying to emulate figuratively, but rather just think of them as sort of fantasy fixtures. The whole thing, including the you're talking about the sculptural elements in the piece. But I want to tell you a little bit about that. So the city used to hang these really kind of now from, you know, looking at it from a 21st century aesthetical standpoint, these very strange,
sad,
kind of like almost kind of creepy.
Sort of Jack in the Box creepy.
Weird clown.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, scary clown.
Scary clown, creepy.
Scary Santas.
And in fact, one of the four, these were vintage Christmas ornaments that the municipality, year after year after year, hung on the lamppost downtown, and they decorated the, you know, announced the holiday season. I don't know where they got them. We've been trying to kind of figure that out. We haven't really been able to track down a manufacturer or point of origin. We don't know if they were made up here or they were shipped up from, you know, Seattle or what. Maybe if somebody out there knows, that would be interesting to, because we spent some time actually trying to figure that out. Not a lot, but.
How did they come into your possession?
Well, the city was wanted to get rid of them.
We're done with these.
This was long before my time.
Yeah, absolutely. The city wanted to get rid of them because they discovered them by surprise when they were clearing a piece of land, a city-owned land down in one tip of Mountain View. As they were negotiating in a sale of that land to create the what's now the Glen Square Mall, and they had some Connex storage units down there, and when they broke into them, nobody had looked at them. Nobody was aware, really, and it had inventoried them. And they were surprised to discover these ornaments sitting there, lying in wait for a couple decades, I believe, since they had been retired. And just through a series of weird phone calls, transactions, I ended up getting asked if we might want these Christmas ornaments.
And when you went down there and you opened the door and you looked? And,
I didn't open the door. I just had this fellow describe them to me. Because at first when he said, are you interested in Christmas ornaments? I said, no, not interested in Christmas ornaments. But then he said, but they're really big. It's like, oh, well, that's a different thing. Big Christmas. So anyway, I called Sheila Wine. She's a sculptor and in the artist community, well known for her her visual artwork that often involves repurposing objects and making art and wonderful art from them. And I called her and said, what do you think about a bunch of big Christmas ornaments? And we talked about it. And she said, all right, bring them down to my studio compound. And that's fine. We'll figure out something to do with them. And so the next thing you know, two big Muni flatbed trucks pulled up onto her studio compound and started offloading these ancient holiday artifacts.
They're made
of
rebar, aren't they? So they're heavy.
They're made of steel.
Yeah. They're tinsely and Santa hats.
They're durable.
Right. They're durable. They were meant to be, they were meant to be exhibited outdoors in an art, subarctic climate, and they did it for a long time. They did it well, and they still held up. They were a lot of the lights on them still worked.
Yeah.
But we took all that stuff off, and people, when they come down to the installation, they'll be able to. We're creating a little kind of information kiosk, where not only people can learn about the background and some of the story involved in this piece, but we're going to display one each of the four original Christmas ornaments. We turned all the rest of them into the piece, and we saved these four so that people could actually look at them and
the genesis of this.
And see what they're made of. It's not just the six major size sculptural ornaments, though, that we used the original ones for. They also are the bases, and people aren't really going to see these because they're going to be lying flat on the surface of the park, but they're going to be the bases that hold up 850 or so clear rods that are acting as kind of fiber optic sculptures themselves. And and these rods are 6 feet tall, and they're just going to be kind of waving and wafting throughout the space in the park. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they're standing up is because they're connected to these original ornaments that are the foundation of them.
Did our lack of snow or our minimal snow make anything difficult for you, or is it making things difficult for you, or it's fine, doesn't matter?
I mean, we don't know what it would have been like to do it in a deep snow, but because, we've never done it before. But I think all in all, it's been kind of lucky.
You just deal with it.
You have to.
Yeah.
That's just one of the things about doing site-specific work outdoors is that you can't really, you just have to plan you have to try to create a project that can happen no matter what.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like going camping in Alaska. You just do it.
Just go.
Yeah. So I want to ask Mike, I want to bring you back in here, Mike. You're an architect. I always think of architects as having all kinds of aesthetics. And have you visited? Have you seen what they're doing? Or is it going to be a surprise for you on Saturday?
It'll be excuse me. It'll be a surprise for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I have not necessarily intentionally, but I've stayed away.
You want to have fresh eyes.
Yep. And you know, the exhibit at the museum, the performance in the museum, heard a lot about it, a lot of pre-information, but you know, being there and seeing it fresh was just inspiring. So I can only imagine how well the piece that they're putting together now is gonna turn out.
Yeah. I think the museum really did a lot. So many people could see that, and so many people did see it. I think I heard you say 5,000 people.
That's what the museum security staff came up. That's the number they estimate.
Right. And some of your other, you know, I was at the bridge with the projections underneath the bridge that goes over to Government Hill. And I don't think there were 5,000 people there, you know. I mean, you know, so it's be careful what you wish for, Bruce. You might get.
Yeah.
Let's see. I also want to let folks know that sound is a big part of this. And when we come back from our break, we're not going yet. We have a couple minutes, but we have a treat for folks, which is a sound file that was created by Christopher Jetty, who's a composer working with this group. And so we're going to hear his really lovely voice telling us a little bit about the sound, and then we're going to dial him down at the project and talk with him a little bit. They're actually, as we said earlier, they're installing, and the work is going on now, and so we'll get a little bird's eye view. We're radio, so you can't actually have images, but we're going to get his through his eyes. We're going to have some images. So I have been down to the Church of Love and have seen, I mean, it's like a beehive. I mean, I want to talk to you about obsession and, you know, how it takes over, not just the core four and not just the, but people, I mean, I know the other day someone saw a notice somewhere and wanted to come down and volunteer and just kind of joined you, you know, so it's
yeah,
just.
Yesterday, I believe it was, a woman came into Anchorage drove in from Soldotna to do some Christmas shopping, I think, sat down in a coffee shop and read an article in the Free Weekly, the Anchorage Press, about it, and showed up at the church saying, I have a few hours, I'd like to volunteer if I can.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
That's really amazing. And let's tell people a little bit about that church. It's empty. It's not being occupied by a church anymore.
It's an old church from the mid-50s. We've learned a lot about it being in there. People show up and tell you history of things sometimes,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And we've learned that it was a real community center for a long time. A lot of the community activities kind of revolved around it. But this was before there were things like rec centers in the neighborhoods and so on. It kind of functioned as that. For a long time, it was the Baptist church. And then the Baptists moved out and a Korean congregation moved in and used it as their place of worship for, gosh, quite a while. And that's when the sign outside used to read Love Church, and people would drive by it, and I did many, many times, and I was always fascinated by that, just the idea of it. And then the Korean congregation moved out, and Cook Inlet Housing Authority purchased the property, and they're going to redevelop it at some point. But in the meantime, they kind of decided that there'd be no harm in letting us just sort of use it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to be there according to their plans for too much longer, but they're letting us kind of wring the last little bit of life out of it.
That's great.
And it's fun.
And what's perfect about it is how roomy it is.
Correct.
Mean, I did get to visit, and I don't know that you would have had a space if you hadn't come upon this space.
No, we're really grateful for Cook Inlet.
To do this work.
Perfect. And you don't have that happen that often, where you need something and then you get it, and it's also exactly what you need.
The universe answers. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. We have Bruce Farnsworth on from the Light Brigade, Susan Duck from the mayor's office and working on the Centennial Project, which is going to go full swing in 2015, and Mike Prozoralek from the Live, Work, Play initiative at the AEDC. And don't forget, when we come back, we're going to listen to a really fun sound file that's going to give us a taste of what you might hear at this installation. And we will also be hearing from Christopher Jetty, who I see is on the line and waiting to talk to us. So you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and this is Kathleen McCoy.
Thank you. You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we're having a great conversation today about a cool thing that's going to happen Saturday and go on for 3 weeks. So if you can't be there Saturday, don't panic. You could still participate in it. We have Bruce Farnsworth from the Light Brigade, Susan Duck with the City, and Mike Prozorelic from KBB Architects and from AEDC, the Live Work Play Initiative. And just before we took a break, we promised you that you were going to get to hear something really special. This comes from the Light Brigade crew. It's a little bit of an explanation of how the sound is being developed at the site and some samples of what you're going to hear. So we're just going to go ahead and listen to that.
Follow the Light is a sound and light sculpture installed in Elderberry Park. The sounds are literally piped through the park with 4-inch PVC-like pipes that shape the sounds. The particular moment-to-moment mix is the result of a compositional plan and the input of people moving within the park. Movement triggers changes in the sound composition, which are amplified by changes in the light behavior. Both the sound and the light are used to sculpt a new sense of space within Elderberry Park. The first layer of sound is an undulating acoustic mass with 4 distinct sections. Like the individual trees combining to create a forest, the individual sounds have different characters but sum up to create 4 unique sound masses. Here's an example of that first layer. The second layer of sound is composed of triggered sound events. The lighting and sound both react to the presence of people by using motion detection sensors. When the sensors detect a person in a particular area of the park, the character of the sound and light sculptures changes. The sound world changes by adding a new sound layer. There are 8 distinct families of sounds that can be added, and depending on where the person is and how they move, a different member of each family is triggered. Those sounds can add up to create new sounds. Here are some examples of those triggered sounds. Most of the sounds used in the park are created from recordings of the materials employed in constructing the physical sculptures. By doing this, the sound world within the park reverberates with fragments and echoes from the process of building the sculptures and the sounds of the raw materials. As the sound sculpture evolves, the echoes of the past are reused and rearranged to suggest new combinations. Here is an example of a metallic component and then a sonic gesture composed from that sound.
You're back with us in the studio. That was a sound file that was created for us by Christopher Jetty. And I'm so happy to say that we have Christopher on the phone. Hi, Christopher.
Good afternoon.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Thank you for taking the time. I know you're part of that troop that is working so hard to launch this event down at Elderberry Park. And since we're on the radio, we asked you if you'd walk over there and tell us what you see as volunteers are working to, install this sound and light event. So what do you see? Where are you?
Okay, so I'm actually just at the parking lot in Elderberry Park. There is one sculpture that just had the last row of LEDs turned on, so we actually have one functional sculpture right now of the 6. The crew of about eight people has moved on to the second sculpture, and they're starting to wire that one up. I was down here earlier testing out some of the sound. We wired up the tunnel last night, and I have a couple of tests to run now that I can actually get into space and see how things are going to play out.
Are people noticing, or are they just working, you know, in other words, non-installers, are people wandering around curious about what you're doing, or is it pretty quiet there right now?
Well, maybe the greatest impediment to getting any work done is everyone stopping and having a conversation with us.
Okay.
There's a lot of curious folks who've been walking by for the past couple weeks, just saying, oh, this is what those little flags were about. Oh, what are you guys doing? And so, yeah, there's a lot of people stopping and walking their dogs and having conversations.
And what the crew says to these folks when they come up and strike up a conversation is, if you want to know more about this, go on the Indiegogo crowdfunding site. There's a video that will tell you a lot about it.
And there is a good video. Really, yeah. Really helpful. Yeah, yeah.
So, how about that for sneaking in a
plug? Nice segue there.
Yeah, right.
But no, that really is what the crew told me that they keep telling people. It's like, you want to know what we're doing? Go to Indiegogo and go on their search projects function and type in follow the light. And you'll go right to a video that will tell you a lot of information.
It's great. It's much like the file that Christopher prepared for us. It just gives you a tease and a little bit of background and... Christopher, I just wanted to ask, you're a composer. Are you from Anchorage? How did you get involved with the Light Brigade?
I'm not from Anchorage. I grew up in the Midwest, went out to the East Coast, came out west. Then I was in Anchorage about 8 years ago, got accepted to a PhD program in California. So I went down there, did that, and then decided to come back up. And I stumbled into the Light Brigade upon returning. And then it just kind of snowballed from there.
How did you stumble into the Light Brigade?
Did you see it of the light?
I've done a lot of interactive work, and I had a piece specifically that I worked with a dancer with, and I had followed the Light Brigade kind of from a distance through the media. And although I missed Over, Beyond, and Through, I was aware of it, and I knew of Becky Kendall, and so I sent her an email, and she totally lost the email and responded to it 6 months later, the first week that I moved up here, and said, hey, we're having a meeting tomorrow. You should come. So
that's great. And then you've been hooked ever since, huh?
Precisely.
And, you know, my little visit to the church there, there's a lot of computers involved, but there's glue guns and there's LED lights and there's, I don't know, duct tape. And did you compose these pieces? Well, I guess they're triggered by the audience, but you've assembled the sound.
Yeah. So I took all the materials that we're using to make the sculptures, and I sampled all of them. And a lot of different electronic music will use samples from various places. And I thought, well, hey, this is a great way to take these sculptures and actually make them sing, quite literally, for the park. And there's just a lot of different hardware involved, so I tried to incorporate that all into there. And then I created a software that is open enough to allow people to interact with the park, but at the same time, it has sort of an inherent logic to it. And so that was my challenge in this.
You know, one question I have, and anybody can answer it, Chris or Bruce or Susan or Mike. If a lot of people are there and they're all triggering this at the same time, is it going to be a cacophony, or what's it going to be like?
Beautiful music.
I'm probably in the best position to answer that because I'm writing that code, or I was writing that code this morning. I put certain limits on it so that it wouldn't get out of control, but that the idea is to sort of reflect the how much activity there is, but not to the point of actually aggressively getting in the face of the viewer or the listener. And that's a hard line to find. That's part of what we're testing in the park right now.
Mm-hmm.
Installing little bits of it and testing it out and see, hey, how's this work? How's this sound?
Right. Okay. Well, Chris, anything else you want to share with us? I'm going to let you get back to work. I know you've got a lot to do. It was hard to even squeeze a little bit of time out of your time there today. Anything else you want to share with the audience before we say thank you and let you go back to work?
No, it's just we're just thankful for everybody stopping by and lending their support and.
But let you get the work done.
All right, take care.
All right, thanks a lot, Chris. Really appreciate it, and really appreciated the sound file you provided to us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. So I was talking about obsession, but actually, I mean, I think anybody that creates is obsessive. I mean, you get engaged with it and you can't stop, you know. But I would like to talk about the pieces of it. I mean, what I saw, well, we had a picture on the website of this light designer testing. It's fascinating. That was just a, what was that about? I mean, is that, we're not going to see that down there, but we're going to see these things lighting up. But what were they testing? Just trying to make things work?
Yeah, this isn't one of those, you know, everybody's kind of used to Christmas ornaments that flash and change colors and so on. But those are almost always, if you purchase those commercially, they're set on a preset kind of very, very limited group of possibilities and functions. What we had in mind was actually making a piece of art, and to do that, we had to be in control of the lighting fully, and it had to be designed as a light painting almost. And so that's what's being tested, is all of the different ways to change colors and levels of intensity. And we had one of the workshops in the Church of Love that we called the Light Lab, and it was exclusively for testing our various components as well as our various theories of light. The piece is really, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about the piece that hasn't come up yet, so the piece, if listeners can kind of imagine it as consisting of three integrated, parts. There is the sculptural elements, as we call them, and those are made for, you know, those are the larger, like about 6 foot tall pieces made from the ornaments. There's the light field, which are attached to the ornaments, but as using them as a foundation, and those flow around on the contours of the park, and they are lit very, very differently, much more subtly and much more individually. And then there's the sound component that we just talked about and heard Christopher describing. There's one other element that's not visual or sonic, but is about the electricity. And there's a position on the site that we call the energy hub, where we're going to be making energy right there to help drive all of those other elements, the sound, the lights, and so on, because they all require electricity. But we wanted to both literally and symbolically point the discussion about energy in the direction of the future and get people to start, you know, to join the conversation about, yeah, what will we be doing for energy in the next 100 years? It's certainly not always going to be about the gas-fired, you know, grid. And establishing an array of solar panels, and we're going to invite the public to come and generate electricity on some power-generating stationary bikes that are going to be arrayed on the energy hub as well.
So you should invite some spin class to come down there and really power it up for
you. I think, you can work out before you enjoy the
Yes.
One of Susan's colleagues in the mayor's office actually teaches a spin class and said she's definitely bringing her spin class down there. The way that will work is there's one specific sculptural element called Sol, S-O-L, that's going to be stationed in the energy hub, and it's wired up so that each of the bicycles is connected to one of the sections of the lighting. So if Susan or Mike went down there by themselves and got on a bike, if they pedaled really hard, they might be able to light up that one specific section. But if they get four of their friends, or if they hail some strangers in nearby and say, "Hey, come jump on a bike and help me light this whole thing up," then they have the possibility of lighting up all five parts of the thing. So we're really encouraging not only interactivity, but group interactivity.
Yeah. So enlisting strangers you don't even know to hop on a bike with you.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that we're most intrigued by about this kind of placemaking, this sort of this new way of bringing art out into the community instead of asking people to come in where the art is that it sets up situations where people might just end up having a conversation about art with somebody they don't even know, let alone, you know, have ever discussed art with.
Right. And I think it's really fun. I mean, you are not having an opening event, actually. That's, you know, a lot of people expect, oh, there's going to be an MC and they're going to put on a show for me. But that's not the way this thing is working.
We're not having an opening event because we don't really actually know when it's going to open.
So am I wrong to say it's December 20?
No, that's the target date. But the reality is that our crew will be down there working on this, installing it and troubleshooting it until it's complete. And that might be Saturday afternoon. It might be Friday night. It might be Sunday. It might be Monday. But basically, to me, it's interesting to go and experience it no matter what's going on.
Whatever,
whether it's people
it's
down there testing and working and troubleshooting, or whether it's a fully functioning and finalized or not.
Right.
It's a soft opening, I think, is how we like to rethink of it.
We have an email, and I think this is a show of support. It's coming from George Rooney, and I know that he's been down there and helping you guys. It says, "Follow the light," from the Tunnel Man.
Oh, yeah. George just wants to be acknowledged.
Has he been laboring hard?
George is amazing. He's one of our long, long standing supporters. And every time we do a project, it turns out that there is something that has to happen to make that project work that only George Rooney really can do.
Right.
The guy just jumps in and does it. And
he's an engineer, I think, right?
Well, you know what? He is. He's a mechanical engineer, but really, mostly, I think he's just attention deficit disorder.
Follows bright shiny
eyes. Yeah, no. And talk about obsessive. In this case, though, what he did was he took over a part of the project that's really special to us, and he made it happen, and that's the activation of the tunnel. We haven't talked about that, but in addition to these other elements, and I forget it, not because I want to, I just kind of hate disclosing the surprise that part is, because you don't see it until you actually go through the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly there you are in the tunnel, and the tunnel itself is coming alive.
Wow. Well, I want to throw out our numbers one more time.
But George was key in making that
so
happen.
Shout out to George Rooney.
Yay, George.
The Tunnel Man. So 550-8433 if you've got a question, or you can send us an email to hometown@alaskapublic.org. I know we wanted to revisit, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, but we wanted to revisit the Centennial Project for a particular reason, and I'm not really sure what it was.
Well, I just wanted to get, Susan and I haven't really had a chance to talk very much about the Centennial, although we've been at meetings and or events where we've each listened to one another present about our project. So I feel like I know quite a bit about what Susan's thinking about the Centennial. And we often talk in public when it comes up about the subject of our piece being about the next 100 years of Anchorage history. And I just want to remind people of that. And I don't think the two concepts of looking back on the history of the official, you know, period of Anchorage's existence and imagining what it's going to do, what we're going to do with the next 100 years. I don't think those things are contradictory or incompatible.
Not at all.
I mean, I don't either.
That's the overall mission statement, if you will, of the Anchorage Centennial. And Mayor Sullivan's vision was that everyone in the community would have an opportunity, to participate either by celebrating or commemorating and sharing their passion for the community or their passion for what they do in the community, not only through history and acknowledging that, but also looking at the promise of the future. We have a lot of hopes of gathering stories and gathering visions from, you know, children all the way up to elders to help us all as a community come together and form what our city looks like for the next 100 years, which, you know, also integrates well with live work play.
Live work play, right.
And so it's events like this that rely on, you know, the passion and the energy of groups like Bruce and the Light Brigade to come together and create these unique, evocative events that can start that dialogue. You know, we can reach people through traditional marketing means, but an experience like that hits home so much deeper and really brings forth the kind of connection that we're looking for.
Right. And Bruce, you did mention that you're fundraising. And one thing I wanted to ask is there was a grant that launched this, but did you go way beyond that? I mean, or was it that
we didn't go beyond it as way as we wanted to?
Uh-huh. You held back.
Well, no, we were unsuccessful. In some ways. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, I feel like we've been really fortunate to have been you know, granted funds by organizations that think that our work is worthy. We got a grant from the through the Centennial Celebration Committee, a kind of roundabout. It was money that we, it was a grant that we received from the Alaska Humanities Forum that was funded by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Right.
So for Centennial Community
for
Grants.
For Centennial. We also got some funding from Art Place America, a creative place, the National Creative Placemaking Funder. We've got some other smaller, we've cobbled together several, sources of funding. It's been tough, and we're still in the fundraising mode. We'd like to, we need to raise more money, and that's what the Indiegogo crowdfunding project is all about. So I'm hoping your listeners will spread the word and go on Indiegogo, search Follow the Light, and contribute. We've only got about three more days of this fundraising campaign, and we need to raise another few thousand dollars to be able to pay all of our bills. And it's not because we're bad managers of our finances. Mm-hmm. It's just that a project like this has many, many, many unexpected and unanticipated things come up, and we have to, you know, there's things you have to do and money that you have to spend on those things.
Yeah.
And that's,
well, you know,
that's
I have a question, because artists that I know often say, well, everybody wants us to donate our work, and we donate, and yet really when you look at Live, Work, Play, they want artists around because that turns a community into an economic healthy place. And I want to ask Mike, how does that happen? How does that work? Is it because people love artists? They just want to be around them?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, just bringing awareness to what artists contribute to the community. I mean, they do an awful lot of donating pieces and everything else. And, you know, it is really hard after a period of time to continue to ask, you know, a market sector in our community to continue to do that. Live, Work, Play, the whole creative placemaking component is, you know, the business community standing behind the importance of art in the community, how many jobs it brings to the community through different activities, different businesses, how art can enhance, you know, our own companies through visual stimulation and a lot of other things. And the things that they're doing out in public space and private spaces that just, you know, energize those areas and bring life to the
things
community.
Things that you don't think of. Like,
right.
I was reading some of the placemaking documents and things like people not leaving Alaska to go have an adventure but deciding to stay here because it's interesting enough just to be here.
Yep.
Or that having, you know, people out in Elderberry Park and this event in Elderberry Park and this ongoing exhibit in Elderberry Park makes Elderberry Park a safer place because there's lots more people out there enjoying it. So it has these things that you don't actually think about.
Well, we think about that sort of stuff all the time because one of I think it's fair to say that part of our mission is to help Anchorage emerge as a being among the great winter cities in the circumpolar north. And I think people are getting more and more aware of kind of that concept. People have been talking about it, especially in the design field, for a long time, this idea of winter cities. And there's a lot of different, you know, dimensions of it.
Sure.
But it is a real thing. It's an actual term. And Anchorage just hasn't. A lot of these other cities have consciously embraced that term and sought to kind of define their strategic growth and development plans
around being
a great winter city. We think Anchorage is ready to start having that conversation.
Right. So who are our neighbors? We're talking Oslo. We're talking all these great cities that we want to be shoulder to shoulder with in terms of the quality of life in a winter city. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a question, by the way, from a caller who just was curious if there's going to be photography at the site, and if people are engaged with it, will they be photographed without knowing it? It's a public park, so...
Yeah.
Okay. So there we are, what do you call that? We're installing a time-lapse camera in the park to be able to document the kind of over the time, over the 3 weeks, document the movement of people around in the park. And we, because we're interested in what these kinds of installations actually do and how they, how people behave and so on. People won't be recognizable or identifiable through this. This is, these are the kind of camera that we're using is, they're designed for construction projects to put up high over the construction project. And that way they get a document of the, you know, the phases and stages of the the coming together of a building project and so on, and they're really not high resolution, and we've also positioned it so that it's not going to capture anybody's actual image.
We're not
interested in knowing who came to the park. We're interested in knowing what people did when they came there.
Right. Well, you know,
but that's a good point. I'm glad that person asked that question, because we installed it a few days ago. And I frankly haven't even checked to see if it's been stolen yet or not. So I just don't think about it. And that's probably, you know, that's probably not the proper attitude to have about it. But it's just there's so many other things going on. But that's good to let people know that. So I appreciate that.
And we did make the point that there isn't a big opening event, but there is a celebration coming up. So let's talk a little bit about that, Mike.
Yep. Actually, on January 8th, my office, KPB Architects, is going to host a celebration for the Light Brigade and the event and the centennial. And I believe that we're going to be getting the word out, advertising for this. There's, I'm sure, a select group of individuals throughout the community that have participated and helped promote this effort. And so we're basically going to open our office, which is at 500 L Street, and we have a phenomenal view looking down the hill at the installation.
That's great. That's great.
So the last few days when the trucks have started to pull up, my staff has been looking out the window going, oh, look, they're getting ready. we've been watching Bruce and his crew go through their steps and to start to put this together.
Yeah.
But, Bruce approached me. We had a conversation about an event, and even though we haven't had our official open house yet, we're going to make our space available and allow Bruce to use it.
And so that's a public event, right?
It's a public event. We're going to be selling tickets to it, we're hoping to that the tickets should the opportunity to purchase the $25 tickets to attend. It's going to be wine and cheese and live music. There's a local band in town called Eternal Cowboys that are going to be performing. They're perfect for this kind
of
setting.
That already sounds like fun. Yeah,
it's going to be a blast. So those ticket sales opportunities should be going out.
It's going to be online
by Friday.
Online?
Yeah, it'll be an online ticket.
Okay, so let's just remind folks, you should definitely go check it out on December 20th, but if they're not ready yet, don't panic. It's still coming, and it's going to be there for 3 weeks. There's a public ticketed event, but...
A celebration.
Celebration on January 8th at 500 L Street.
Yep.
So watch for that. And, it made me think that it would be really fun. What are the people that take you through museums and talk to you about?
Docents.
So...
Yes, we have
docents. How about some docents?
No, we've already lined them up. We often partner with Momentum Dance Collective in our work. Not every time, but they're going to be at the celebration, and they're going to be conducting tours of the installation every 15 minutes.
I love that.
All you have to do is come to the event, and then and every 15 minutes, a group will wander down there, docented by a dancer from Momentum Dance Collective.
I really love that. I really love that. Okay, we are out of time. I just really have to say thanks. Thanks so much, you guys, for coming down. It was hard to break away from all the work of just getting this launched, but you came. So thank you to Bruce Farnsworth with the Light Brigade, Susan Duck with the City, the Centennial Project, and Mike Prozorelic from the AED Live Work Play Initiative, and from KPB Architects and hosts of a big public celebration for this. As I said, this is our last show for 2014. I'll be back as your host on January 7th, and we're going to feature therapy dogs, which are becoming very popular in local hospitals and health facilities. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Monica Gokey is our web editor and audio engineer. Happy winter solstice to you all, and thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Oh, Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.